Hello, and welcome to this podcast on the topic of diverse academic leadership as part of the Council of Deans of Health's Race Equity Month 2023. My name is Raina Rogowski, and I am a nurse lecturer in health sciences at the University of Dundee. I will be facilitating the session, which will focus on the topic of diversity in academic leadership. I'm a recent fellow of that Council of Deans of Health, and I am committed to promoting an equality, diversity, and inclusion lens in health sciences and higher education. Participation in the fellowship has hugely impacted my approach to leadership in this area and my confidence as well. I am delighted to be joined today by two fellow colleagues who will be speaking to the importance of diverse academic leadership from their perspectives. Our two speakers are Anisa Admani, Associate Dean for Education and Student Experience at London South Bank University, and Jo Yin Tao, Chair of the Royal College of Occupational Therapists Learning and Development Board and Senior Lecturer at Brunel University London. Can I start with you, Anisa? Just briefly introduce yourself as you like, and tell us how do you feel about the level of diversity in healthcare academic leadership in 2023?
Hi, Raina. Lovely to be here. Thank you for the invite to participate. So I am, as you've said, the Associate Dean for Education and Student Experience at London South Bank University, but very specifically for the School of Allied and Community Health, where I oversee the teaching and learning strategies that are used across the school, and then all of the student experience cycles and general student experience of their courses and any improvement I guess perspectives that we can put into the way that the courses are delivered and run. But I also wear the hat of the Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Committee Chair for the School of Allied and Community Health. And it's with both of those hats that I sit here today and share some of my views. So how I feel about the level of diversity in healthcare academic leadership? Well, I guess my initial instinct is to say that it's still lacking, that there really the level of diversity within academic leadership is still something that we really need to be pushing and working towards changing and developing. However, I come from a university and a school where my particular school is quite unique in its senior leadership team, and that is that all of the senior leaders in the School of Allied and Community Health, that's joined very closely to the School of Nursing and Midwifery, is all female. So all of the leadership, so I'm talking about the deans of both of the schools, both of the associate deans responsible for education student experience, which is my role, and then there are associate deans that are responsible for research and enterprise, and both of them are female as well across both of the schools. So quite a unique situation. In that space, however, I am the only person of that comes from an ethnic background. So the other five individuals are from a white ethnic background. So from that perspective, you don't really tend to see many individuals that I would say either look like me or come from diverse backgrounds. You don't really see individuals in those roles. So that's something that I really definitely think is lacking, and it's something that we do need to look at doing and really focusing on how to get individuals from different groups of society in these areas of leadership, and taking responsibility for students that look like them and come from ethnic backgrounds or diverse ethnic backgrounds. And also, London South Bank has a very diverse student population, especially in the health school. Like the student population is primarily from sort of like I'm minoritized ethnic background groups. And so you don't really see that in the academic leadership, which is something to really think about. I have to give London South Bank some credit for the fact, especially in the health school, they are really looking at trying to increase academic diversity. So at all levels of academia within these particular schools. And we are seeing more individuals getting involved from minoritized backgrounds. But I just come back to that word of it is lacking, and it is something that does need a bit more direct attention and intervention.
Thank you for that. Joyin, can you come in?
Okay, thank you for the introduction, Reena. And I would like to shout out particularly to our wonderful colleagues at the Council of Deans of Health for enabling diverse perspectives to be heard through bringing us together via this podcast opportunity. Now, I'm speaking as a chair of a Royal College National Board, so I am very aware that I am not the conventional academic leader that is represented in council meetings, in the sense that my academic leadership work is primarily situated external to the institution through which I'm employed rather than within it. And this requires me to consider the interests of my profession at a national scale. So I just wanted to make this explicit to provide context to what I'm hoping to discuss later and to help our listeners appreciate the positionality through which I'm approaching the issue we are discussing today. So with regards to diversity in healthcare academic leadership, you know, I think before we answer the question, we really need to consider what we mean by diversity in the first place. You know, is, you know, I know Anissa talked about all women teams, you know, but are all women teams really diverse? You know, they are women. Yeah, sorry. Now, based on the Council's workforce census conducted in 2019, we already know that healthcare academics are disproportionately whiter than the general higher education population. And I think there are also disproportionately more women compared to, you know, the general higher education population in general. And I know some people might say that these statistics are dated, but if you're a name, you, the listener, are a named member of the Council of Deans of Health and you attend meetings with the council on behalf of your institution, you are in the perfect position to make your own observations and come to your own conclusions on how diverse healthcare academic leadership is in this country. And you just attend a meeting, consider the population there, and see how many people you can identify that are visibly not white. And I'm talking about diversity of race and ethnicity specifically because this is a Race Equity Month podcast, but you get the gist of it, you know. Also in terms of gender diversity, not just talking about, you know, men and women, you know, but in terms of other genders, you know, are they visible or not, right? And visible diversity is one thing, but there are also other forms of diversities which are important. And I've just come back from the British Educational Research Association conference where people are talking about diversity at all levels of professional education in academia. You know, from the admissions into initial level, pre-registration training, to postgraduate and doctoral studies, and to the academic workforce, and all the way up to the snowy white peaks of academic leadership. And in one of the sessions about racial diversity in academic leadership, you know, there was a participant who was racially minoritized, and she asked something along the lines of, okay, so racial diversity is all well and good, but how do we know if those racially minoritized leaders are the quotation mark right ones? Like, you know, the UK's cabinet is now the most visibly diverse in its history, right? And how has that visible diversity translated into racial, gender, or just social justice in general? So I guess that kind of sums up how I feel about diversity. On one level, there are the visible aspects of diversity, but it's also important to remember the less tangible aspects as well, such as cognitive diversity. And I think if we are able to amass leadership teams, which are a combination of both, you know, the outcomes could be pretty incredible. I mean, there's a lot of research out there about the benefits of diverse leadership, you know, and I'm just wondering why we're not engaging with it more or doing more about it.
Thank you very much for that. And hopefully the discussion can help shine a light on some of your views on what we can do about it, how we can tackle some of these, the issues that you've both raised. I wonder if we can move to thinking now about some of the key factors that are affecting diversity, particularly at a senior level in academia. Would you like to start us off, Jillian, and then Anissa can respond?
Okay, thank you. Yep. So I have spent a lot of time thinking about diversity issues. This has been, you know, one of the key, it has been a cornerstone of my career, really, you know, and recently what I have found was that some helpful lenses, you know, theoretical lenses, which you can find in research, through which we can understand this issue, is to look at our wicked problem theory in sociology and the leaky pipeline. You know, so just to give people a brief understanding of what wicked problems are, is that these problems are unstructured, they're open-ended, they're multidimensional, systemic with no apparent solution. You know, the saying about how we have the whole being more than the sum of its parts, you know, and so this lack of diversity we see is essentially the manifestation of dysfunctionalities within a complex system, you know. we talk about racism, we talk about ableism, we talk about sexism. These are all interconnected problems. They can't be isolated and separated from the systems from which they emerge from. See, so these are wicked problems as opposed to tame problems, which are more straightforward to solve. You know, and the existing evidence on wicked problems tells us that even when a wicked problem is apparently resolved, you know, this resolution cannot be taken for granted. Now, something might change in the system and the problem might reassert itself in a different form. And I know this sounds really tiring because it just means that you have to constantly be working to address the problem. But that is just how wicked problems work. You know, that's how the world rolls. And I just want to be explicit in case some people misconstrue what I'm saying to mean that the problem will always be there, so we don't need to do anything about it. On the contrary, if you leave them on their own, the systemic issues will actually go from bad to worse. You know, it's like everything we enjoy as individuals, we have to consciously put in effort to maintain them, right? I mean, we have to brush our teeth to maintain them. We have to do maintenance for our homes, maintenance for our cars. So the sooner we accept that having, you know, diverse leadership is part of what makes a good workplace great, and that the work that goes into diversifying that leadership is part of the day-to-day business, then the better our chances of doing something about it. Because at the end of the day, I think the key question is senior management even taking the issue seriously? You know, because based on my observation, whenever senior management decides they want to do something as a priority, they will actually take steps to address it. But if it's not even a priority, then that is probably the most important key factor to focus on, because how is the organization even going to have a vibrant, diverse, thriving leadership if there is no seed planted in the first place?
Thank you for that. It's really interesting to think about where, you know, who's noticing that this is a problem and where recognizing is this actually a priority, the way that we're assuming and talking about it as being a priority. So thank you for bringing that in. Anisa, can you please respond and add any of your own comments?
Yeah, thank you. So, Joyin, it is very clear that you've spent a lot of time thinking about this and doing a lot of work around it, and it needs individuals really paying attention to this issue. I want to just go back very quickly to that point that you made about gender. And yeah, I do accept, because this is a healthcare sort of directed podcast. So healthcare primarily, as we know, is very female dominated. And I made the highlight of the fact that we've got lots of female in senior leadership positions in our particular two schools, because I still feel that we don't see that very much in a lot of, even in the healthcare sector. Like we've been to the Council of Deans to their conferences, and if you were to do a split between the number of males and females sitting in that room, there's still there's a disparity, isn't there? There's a very obvious sort of male dominant space. And so it is something that I speak of a lot, that actually we are female heavy senior leadership teams, because I find a lot of healthcare places are female heavy academics, but a lot of the leadership is still male, which is very interesting. So, you know, it's just a very different culture that comes from that space. And it's something that I, you know, I'm fortunate that I sit in that type of space and I really see the benefit of that. In relation to like what the factors are affecting diversity, it is a very multifactorial and very tightly entwined space based in the historical context of what academia is supposed to be according to history and privilege. But I, when I look at it through a slightly different lens, and I look at it from I'm a very sort of what are the solutions type of person. I'm somebody who really wants to rush forward for a solution. I'm the type of person that wants to make things better straight away. So when I look at that question, that's the first thing that comes to mind, is what are the things that we can go away and do? Because what are the factors that are really affecting them? And I thought about this a lot. And the thing that I keep coming back to is that the mold of what we think an academic should be only fits a certain number of people. And so sometimes it's like that funnel space, no matter how much you have a very large volume that has got the ability to be academics and senior academics, have the right skill set, for them to then be able to fit through the very thin part of a funnel, only so much can get through that space. So for me, it's always about this idea of what fits the mold. And when we think about diversity, this comes back to the point of what you made earlier. We tend to address the points of diversity that, one, are visible, because sometimes we feel like we can do something more about that because it's easier to see and therefore we're able to track what we've done. And two, what's the easiest thing to do? And out of all of the, you know, different categories within increasing diversity within a workforce, the male-female ratio is one of the easiest things that you can go away and address. And so we see actually when companies or businesses are trying to address diversity, the female-male ratio is the first thing that they try and address. And then the next thing after that, which is the one of the more visible things, is race and the color of our skin, really, isn't it? But I think that the factors affecting senior leadership is actually about opportunity and direction, and it's about creating space to allow that to develop. I think we can talk about it, but until you don't create the space and you don't create the ground, it's a bit like creating, you know, having soil that's fertile. Like, you can have soil, but if it's not fertile, it's not actually going to grow anything. It's that idea of creating space in order to be able to address all of these different issues. So yeah, I come back to one of the points that Joanne made far more well than I just did. It's about who's talking about it, and are we having those really difficult conversations, and are we having those conversations very specific to each institutional setting at the time? Because we can talk about this across the board in academia, but actually all of the academic institutions are at different places on this journey, if they're on the journey at all. So when we sometimes talk about it in really big settings, rather than bringing it back to your own and doing your own analysis of where you sit and what are the factors that are affecting your institution, because I think it is dependent on the demographics of your staff, it's dependent on the demographics of your students, it's dependent on the finance opportunities that institution has. Is it internal decisions that we need to make that are different, or are there external opportunities that we need to try? I just think that that conversation it's a really broad conversation, and it's one that needs to be really bespoke to each HEI and that HEI setting. And even then, specific to sometimes each school, like the health school setting is so different to maybe engineering or business, for example. And I find that at London South Bank, that when we have university-wide initiatives, we really have to then break that down and make it really specific to our school, because there's so many things that can or may not apply. So I'm not saying that anything, Joan, you've said that, like, I agree with everything you've said, but then we need to start unpicking that and trying to at least find solutions for the things that we can already unpick. And again, I agree that it's a never-ending journey. And, you know, it's because we have centuries of this mold that we're still trying to fit into that academic leadership should look like, academic leadership should be able to do. And it's not a big mold, and it's not one that lots of people can decide that they belong in that space. So it's a really tough question. But yeah, I think it is about having really, really tough conversations and then identifying what those factors are for each space individually, because they are going to be different.
Thanks for that. Yes, you're sort of kind of looking at where we're hoping to take the conversation next around what can universities do to tackle these factors. And I'm hearing you kind of think about the individual circumstances and context and what needs to be looked at in each of those, and maybe potential roadmaps or ways in to have these conversations that can be difficult and transformative, though. I wonder if you want to kind of go a bit further and talk about what specifically universities can maybe do to tackle these factors, maybe following on from your comments about a bespoke approach. Is there anything further that you might like to add about how universities can tackle these factors? Maybe starting with you, Anissa, and then Joanne, come back in.
I think the first thing is really being in a space where you can have a very open, honest conversation. And that is the biggest challenge, isn't it? It's really tough to be able to address this space. So having those really honest conversations, and the numbers don't lie, do they? We can see how many people from different diverse categories are within certain roles. We do get that. That data has been shared, like across the UK, there is data, isn't there, of how many Black professors there are out there, how many like people from different, you know, ethnic minoritized backgrounds are actually within academia and then within leadership roles or sitting as deans, sitting as provosts. Really using that data, first of all, and then making it applicable to our university. I'd want to sit down with that data and then say, well, what is the, what's this, what's the case here at London South Bank specifically? I know that there are a lot of really great programs out there. I've been on a couple, like the Council of Deans' Fellowship Program was really a great opportunity for us, you know, as a group. And we really learned a lot from each other and had some really tough conversations over that journey. And also I've been on other programs like Diversifying Leadership. You know, Diversifying Leadership is a program that's for individuals from minoritized ethnic backgrounds to come together to discuss sort of leadership within academia. And then there are other programs like Aurora, which is really based around female leaders, for example. So having opportunities to participate in programs is really important. But I really think the biggest thing, and I think that I sit in a position of senior leadership in academia today, and a really big part of that was mentorship and allyship. That is the reality. I've had really great allyship over the course of my career. Now, we could probably say that there's not that many people, if you asked a room full of academics, whether they really feel like they've got allyship, or do they feel like they have really healthy and forward-thinking mentorship relationships of individuals that can help them navigate that road. I think that's something that we really need to think about. And it needs to be not a standardized program that's kind of put out to all academics in that space, but I think each academic has the right and is deserving of having something identified that is helpful and useful for them. Finding the right mentor obviously is one of the biggest challenges in those. These are just some sort of like basic solutions that I know I've been lucky to go through. So obviously I can speak on them authentically because I've been through that experience. And I'm sure that there are probably academics out there that might be listening to this podcast and say, no, like I had mentorship and actually I didn't really think that that was very useful. So I do speak from my own personal experience. I do think that there's a really big part of one, seeing role models in that space. So do we have enough people from diverse backgrounds? And I keep coming back to race because that is one of the things that I really, you know, I'm working on at the moment as in my EDI chair role. It's something that I'm very passionate about. Are there people speaking up from those, that people that look like you? You know, I went into an interview when I was prepping for this interview for this role, and I said I don't actually see many people that look like me in this role. And it was only again because I had strong allyship and real strong support that I felt actually, you know, I really owe it to myself and owe it to the individuals that have been there through this whole journey with me to really try. And if I don't get the job and I don't do well in that interview, I'll have learned something. It'll be better for next time if I try to go for it again. But I really felt like I had to try. Are there many people in that position that feel like they see somebody that looks like them and think, you know what, I could be in that person's shoes in the future. I could be doing what they're doing. Are there people that aspire for something big and you're making those small steps and inroads towards that? And who are you telling? These feel like really basic things. Is there anybody that you can go and tell and say one day, actually, I think I want to be a dean one day. I want to be in that level of academic leadership. I know it's many years away. It might be 7, 8, 9, 10 years away. But what are those small steps I can be taking to get myself to that position? And I think some of that is those, a bit like you said, those roadmaps. And I think that they're different for people from these groups than it is for people that come from backgrounds that have privilege naturally attached to it. So I feel like we need to do some work on what does it take? Like, I spend a lot of time with individuals nowadays talking about what my path has been. What were the different things that I engaged in? What were the different things that I participated in? Where did I develop certain skills that have helped me then go away and apply for certain jobs that have got me to where I am today? I had a conversation with someone very recently and said there used to be a time where I would say yes to everything. I would do everything. And actually, the further I got into my career, the more I realized that my time is of as much value as anybody else's time. And therefore, I now need to be a little bit more reflective on what it is that I am saying yes to and why I'm saying yes to that. Not just to be seen in every single sphere, so to be seen that I'm developing all of the necessary skills that might be required for me in the future, but having a more thought out plan for myself. So I think some of that is about road mapping and putting things together that look like these are the steps that can be taken, and opportunities of being educated, networking, and being put in the right position and being allowed to explore that space. But all of these things, which is the downfall of it, is dependent on individuals in a space of privilege providing that space. And that in itself isn't fair either, because why should people from ethnic minority backgrounds have to really rely on somebody else to give them that space opening? So I think it's sitting down and having very, very honest conversations at your school level, within your university, to see what is happening and where are the barriers for individuals from different groups. Sorry, I was really, yeah. You know, I always want to have a really definitive answer. I'm that type of person. And the more we discuss this, the more barriers we really realize that there actually are. But until we don't actually discuss all of those different barriers, how do we ever plan to get to a place where we can say, this is what we should think, this is what we think we should be doing?
Well, thank you for that. I mean, sharing authentically your experience and your observations and your settings, these are really good examples for how we can kind of come together and work together collaboratively across institutions, across schools, across different groups. And so thank you for that. And Joanne, I wonder if you can respond or share your own comments around this. What can universities do to tackle these factors that we've been talking about in relation to academic diverse academic leadership?
Yep. So, you know, thank you very much, Anisa, for, you know, sharing your perspective, you know, and I do have a point to address, you know, about programs. There is a program that I recently signed up for. You know, we were talking about the fellowship scheme, Aurora and such. Advanced Higher Education, Advanced HE, has a diversifying academic leadership program that is focused around race. And you were talking about road mapping, Anisa, and things like that. So all those are actually part of the program. That was what I found really interesting about it. And what this program actually requires the participants to do is that we need to secure a sponsor from our institution. Now, this is also related very much to your point, Anisa, about allyship and mentorship, you know. But a sponsorship specifically is supposed to involve somebody in your institution who is actively giving you opportunities. You know, it's not just about mentorship and guidance talking about things, but actually giving you the opportunities. They're in your institution, they are working close to you, and their responsibility by signing up to be a sponsor on this program means that they are committed towards giving the person opportunities to do whatever they need to do to reach their goals. And I think that is a very important point to bring up, and that's why I quite like that program, because I was recently in some conversations with colleagues about these various mentorship programs for people on, you know, for women, for, you know, women of color, and etc. And, you know, I've been a mentor on some of these programs myself, and one key thing that you know, my colleague was saying, you know, who is an EDI expert, she was saying that a lot of these programs don't really work. People attend these programs and then, okay, they've completed the program. And then, you know, what next? You know, what are the outputs that they generated out of it? You know, what can they show for it? So I think this is also something that among us ourselves as fellows on the Council of Deans program that we've had conversations about as well, you know, and having graduated from the program, we're currently working on a very exciting project so that we can actually have some outputs to generate from it. Now, going back to what we were discussing about universities addressing, you know, and these factors and promoting diversity within academia, we have talked about, you know, first step is to recognize that there is a problem and to have the motivation to do something about it. And there's a lot I can say about the initiatives to address racial inequalities in my workplace. You know, we look at race ethnicity awarding gaps at modular level in exam panels. You know, I've recently received an email on behalf of the dean is trying to seek input on how to increase representation of people from underrepresented groups who tend not to apply for leadership roles because they've monitored the applications for leadership roles over a period of time. And then they realize that, okay, you know, people are not applying for them. Why are they not applying for them? And it's really good that my workplace is actually taking initiative to even consider, to even want to start to look at these things and even start to have these conversations. And I really appreciate all of them. But I think at the root of it is that, you know, would these actions even be happening if senior management didn't even consider inequalities to be a priority in the first place? You know, or if people didn't keep reminding senior management about the issues until they decide to take notice, yeah? But let's say you are in an institution, you know, I know that a lot of the listeners to this, well, I hope that a lot of the listeners to this podcast are academic leaders themselves in your institutions, and you're wondering, you know, oh, what can we do, you know, at an institution level? And so you're ready for action, you're already making the space, and you're already having those conversations, you know, like Anissa has very nicely articulated. And then you start wondering, okay, what else can I do? Now, there is one thing that I would advise your institution to do, which I think you might not be doing yet, because I think a lot of institutions are not doing this yet. And it would be to take a page from the latest AHP strategy for England, which has a strong emphasis on the use of co-production, you know, to develop anti-racist initiatives. So are you already, you know, as an academic leader, I'm speaking to you as an academic leader, are you already making an active effort to collaborate with stakeholders who have had a track record in racial and social justice work in higher education? Are there any academics, you know, who are already doing racial justice work, who are already doing social justice work that you haven't yet engaged and you haven't yet brought them on board? Are you making an active effort to reach out to them? Because, I mean, this is a conversation I've had with my former PVC education, who has since retired, you know, was that we do have racial justice experts in this university, you know, but sometimes when the university tries to do things, those experts don't engage with the university. And has the university ever wondered why? And has the university ever tried to reach out to find out why? So I think making that active effort to reach out is really important. Let's take, for example, the Universities and Colleges Union. Gender, disability, and race pay gaps have been part of their four fights since 2019. And if you're an academic leader listening to this podcast, have you been proactive in at least reaching out to your local branch or union representative? These are just some of the things to think about. My university's Access and Participation Unit back in 2020 or 2021, I think it's around 2021, decided to provide internal funding for projects to address race-based educational inequalities at the localized and departmental levels. And that has allowed me to expand my racial justice work significantly and in very creative ways. We built into our programs a system which is, you know, looking at preparing students from racially minoritized backgrounds to think about becoming academic leaders. So these are some of the localized solutions that the university can do. Then, and you know, whether the university is actually engaging with the stakeholders and actively making an effort to address this. I think at the end of the day, you know, it does go back to the will to actually wanting to do something. But if you have already decided to do something, then the next step is, are you even engaging? Are you engaging the right stakeholders? You know, are you attracting them to want to work with you?
Thanks a lot for that, for kind of summarizing some of the points raised and inspiring Anissa to respond. Can you come in, Anissa?
Yeah, it was a bit of a reflection, really, on Jo Yin and what you said, and all amazing stuff and some really great things for people to think about. And you obviously are very sort of deep in the work around anti-racist practice. Like we have in the School of Allied and Community Health, we're very lucky that we have an anti-racist fellow who that's some of their role for part of the week. And the conversation at the level that you're having, having those individuals around the table that are really doing this work at this level of depth, like that conversation would be really inspiring and really enlightening, actually, because you guys are all really engaging and really deep thought around these concerns and these challenges that we have in academia. In relation to the kind of things that we can do, coming back from it specific to the role that I sit in, and then our experience from the Council of Deans, bringing a group of us around the table and being able to have those really free-flowing conversations, and being able to have being able to say what we want to say without having to really think about how not to offend somebody around the table was actually really important, to be able to really authentically speak. And then if you've said something incorrect, or you've said something, you know, that somebody may not have liked, it was a very respectful way that we kind of shared that information and allowed somebody else to learn how what you said could have been said in a different way. Do you see where I'm going? Like that really sort of conversational space that has a real purpose, but is really sort of authentic to the person you are in that moment in time, is really, really important. And off the back of that, I really use that a lot in my job space now. So if actually somebody said, what kind of things could we do going forward to be able to attract people from diverse backgrounds, for example, coming back to race as the characteristic that we're looking at, I'm actually really keen to get the academics around the table that do come from minoritized backgrounds and say, actually, let's talk about this. Like, how was your experience coming in? What other things would you have liked to do? You know, I've been talking to a colleague recently where we were actually saying, wouldn't it be really great that if there was a job advert, there was almost like an open day where people could come and have a conversation about that job and talk about what that job is really going to entail, you know, what kind of support they're going to get, etc. Not that it's a post-interview question that we ask in a really formalized setting, but really come and meet people, come and see what it, you know, I know you can request that, but how often do we do that when we're applying for a job? And you know, get comfortable in participating in something like an interview process that might not feel that naturally to somebody from particular backgrounds than it does for other individuals. So already there's a power imbalance there, isn't there? There's already a benefit imbalance. You know, are there things that we can do from bringing people into academic leadership? For example, when I first started, I actually did some guest lecturing to start with. Could we target great individuals out in practice that come from minoritized backgrounds and offer opportunities to participate in guest lecturing, for example? It's a great first toe dip, isn't it, into the academic world. Do you like that? Do you like being in this setting, giving people the opportunity? And again, when I say I have been incredibly lucky, I know when I worked many years ago at a hospital in Northampton, I'd just finished my master's, I'd come back to work and really interested in the academic side of stuff. And, you know, my manager at the time said, well, they've offered us to run a module, the local university. Why don't you be the point person? Why don't you? I dipped my toe into that space. I hadn't come out of my clinical work. I was still a full-time clinical practitioner. So if I didn't enjoy it, it was a bit of an experience and a great skill developing opportunity. And off I could go back to the clinical world. And it really allowed me to explore different parts of what my career skill spectrum could look like, or I'd want to go away and develop. And it's things like that that we can we go out and really be attracting people, or even, you know, how amazing does it feel to be headhunted for something? You know, when someone headhunts you for a job, could we be going out to find out who are those practitioners within certain fields that we might want to say, come and have a feel, like academia could be for you, unless you've not given it a bit of a try. How do you know? So, you know, sometimes there are really small, you know, great actions that you can take. But I agree with what Jo Yin is saying, is that they have to be informed by the group of individuals that you are trying to attract in the first place. So the people around that table who are having that conversation and sharing that information really matter. It's like going away and making decisions for students' curriculum without actually asking the students whether it's of any benefit to them or if that's what they actually want. So yeah, that just got me thinking about what you were saying there, Jillian, about getting, you know, one, there is that anti-practice fellows or individuals really deeply rooted in that work, which you obviously are. And then on the other side, you know, we're looking at trying to bring in academics, and from a day-to-day experience delivery perspective, can we get those people around the table?
Yeah, thank you both for sharing a lot of great ideas about from your perspective, what can be done, what more can be done to tackle this problem that we've identified, that we feel is a problem. But like you said, I think we've identified that for it might not be a problem that everyone sees. So I hope this session has helped people think about how to look at this problem, how to consider some of the key factors, and start to make some actions in their settings and potentially broader collaborate across institutions, across schools, across disciplines to promote diversity within healthcare academia. I suppose I want to pick up on Julian's point that you said if you are listening, you have identified the problem. So maybe there is something to celebrate there and to also encourage our listeners to share widely this podcast and to broaden its reach for those who are in positions to make difference and who may benefit from hearing about the scope of the problem from your points of view and what you think might be done about it. I think we will be coming to a close now, but I want to give an opportunity if there's anything else you'd like to add about your experience in the fellowship, about what we've discussed today before we close. Just want to give you that opportunity before we sign off. So, Jillian, do you want to come in?
Yeah, I think I just wanted to say, Anisa, I really love the idea of your open day for senior leadership roles, and I hate hunting people to dip their toes into a little bit of senior leadership experience. So maybe this is actually something that I'll take back to my senior management since they're asking us, how can we get more people to apply for these roles? Yeah, great.
Brilliant. All ideas
Brilliant
here
ideas.
are our ideas. So, we're co-producing. So
Yeah, excellent. I'm looking forward to share this podcast with them.
Rowena, actually, I would like to say something on the Council of Deans, and I don't think that we've had the opportunity to say it enough, but it was a very, very fortunate, amazing group of, I want to say 10 because I would be the 11th there. I'm just giving myself some compliments in the process. Group of
You
individuals
deserve them.
that were really, I felt that everybody was really their authentic self around that table. The amount that I learned from just conversations with other academics, and we realized that we all have very, very similar challenges in higher education and our institutions. And that everybody's got the passion and the will to want to make it better and want to change things. And I think that that's amazing. And, it bringing lots of people together that are really passionate about one part of this, for example, if it is, the race element of it, or it is, I don't know, the gender element of it. Sometimes you're going to be more impactful if you're doing a small part of it and with a lot of vigor rather than trying to do so much across the spectrum. So, I really just appreciate different ways of being able to think about things. And that's something that the Council of Deans gave us with this fellowship. So I really just want to, as Joyin started thanking the Council of Deans, I want to end my point of the podcast on thanking the Council of Deans for the opportunity that they gave us. And we really are a group of people that want to give back. So, we'll just keep trying the little bits that we are doing. But yeah, it was a brilliant opportunity. So thank you.
Thank you for that. I completely agree. I would love to close out by echoing the thanks and appreciation to the Council of Deans and also to the group of fellows. It's been such a beneficial program and group of people to collaborate with and to continue to work with. So I think it's a really nice opportunity for us to reflect just the three of us, what we, representing today, but as well the whole group and what we're continuing to kind of take forward. So thank you, Anisa and Joanne, for sharing your insights. And thank you to our audience for listening. Please do also share this session with people in your network. We will be sharing more podcasts all throughout November, as well as webinars, interviews, and blogs as part of Race Equity Month. You can find out more and engage with others using the hashtag Race Equity Month on X. Thank you very much.